All right, it's another episode with LibertarianProgressive.com, BlogTalkRadio.com/election channel, where we interview independent and third-party candidates who are on the ballots and the only third-party candidates who are on the ballots in their specific district or area or states. And if you go to our website, LibertarianProgressive.com, by the end of this weekend, we'll have more than 20 candidates, probably about 22, 23, 24, and another week or so, we'll have 50-plus candidates that you can see as alternate solutions, options, besides Republican or Democrat. Most of these are for Congress. Today, we have an interview with Frank Gilbert, who is a Libertarian, who is on the ballot for the U.S. Senate in Arkansas, and you can read more about him at frankgilbertforsenate.com. And so if you're looking for an alternate, you know, most polls say that, you know, people would like to throw them all out. Well, and that means the Congress. I mean, we don't really get into presidential politics with libertarianprogressive.com. It's very divisive, very polarizing. All right. So, here we have Frank calling in right now. Let's bring him online. So, Frank, good day. I actually gave you an introduction. This will be rebroadcast later at libertarianprogressive.com. And again, people, we are talking with Frank Gilbert, frankgilbertforsenate.com, libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate in Arkansas. And he's the only third-party option for Senate in that state. And so welcome, Frank. Good to talk with you today.
Oh, my pleasure. And I appreciate your patience.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you putting yourself on the ballot so we can have this interview with you and that your potential constituents will have a another option. And so may I ask you, you know, there's so many Republicans and Democrats in government, but in fact, actually, most people are registered as independent. Overwhelmingly, but why are you choosing to run as a Libertarian, not a Republican or a Democrat this year?
Well, became familiar with the Libertarian Party back in 1980 when Ed Clark ran a presidential campaign, ran some really interesting two-minute ads on national television, thanks to his vice presidential candidate, one of the Koch brothers. Spent some personal money in the campaign. And at the time, I was a Goldwater Republican, liked some of the things that Ed said, and thought that he, like most libertarians, were just confused, you know, didn't understand the realities of the world. But over the next couple of years, it became obvious to me that the Republican candidate that I had voted for in 1980 hadn't been truthful. And so I went back and got in touch with some local libertarians who helped me to understand that it wasn't libertarians who were confused, but it was me. You know, that if you want liberty for yourself, you have to be willing to give it to everybody else. And once you realize that, it becomes an easy thing to become a libertarian. And philosophically remained a libertarian even when I joined the Republican Party a few years later with a group called the Republican Liberty Caucus. We were going to go in and take over the Republican Party and make it more libertarian, and that didn't work out well either. Huh? So I returned to my libertarian roots in 2012 and ran for the state senate here in Arkansas, and have been running for some elective office as a libertarian ever since, not so much in the expectation of being elected to that office, but in the hopes of spreading the message that Ed Clark did to me, these many years ago. And the best way for me to do that is to stand for office, go to debates, go on speaking tours, and just talk to people who live their everyday lives like libertarians, but don't have the choice of voting that way.
Yeah, well, what I've and thanks for giving people an option to vote that way, instead of having to write someone in. You know, you're actually on the ballot, and what I've observed is it appears to me a lot of people who are one of the major parties use it as a stepping stone. A lot of times they don't even finish their term because, you know, that stepping stone. And a lot of people who are third party candidates, whether you agree with them fully or not, you can admire, you know, they're doing it for the right reasons, it seems. Either they're principled, they believe in competition, you know, they see something that they don't, is just not right. And so, well, let's look at your platform here. I mean, you have your website, frankgilbertforsenate.com, home, about, platform, news, donates, contact. And on your platform, you know, it says things like fiscal responsibility and a paragraph to explain that, non-interventionist foreign policy, respect the 10th Amendment, the 2nd Amendment, close the Department of Education, close the Department of Homeland Security, and end the IRS. So how about let's start with the bottom up. I mean, end the IRS. Yeah. What would you replace it with anything? What would you do for revenue and spending instead of the IRS? And why would you replace the IRS? Or
well,
it?
The IRS is probably the most intrusive and one of the most corrupt departments of our federal government. You know, what they did to the Tea Party folks was criminal, and they've gotten by with it so far and probably will continue to. It also opens up a degree of control for the federal government through its tax policy that free people shouldn't put up with. I certainly would change, you know, something. I'm not an anarchist yet, so the government has to have the income, has to have the ability to do those things that we expect a government to do until we decide that the free market can do it better. And I tell my friends when I hear them arguing about which tax solution is better, you know, I'll go with the fair tax, flat tax, free tax, no tax. Any solution is better than what we have now, because the IRS, as it's currently constituted, is a tyranny that just has to be ended, and nearly anything we do would be better.
Yeah, so there definitely needs to be some kind of reform and change. I mean, the IRS code is huge, and a lot of people spend a lot of time working on it, and when you hear the word IRS audit, it just sends chills up your spine, and, you know, it's supposed to be a service of we the people and not something that, you know, scares you. And
right.
And so what about the Department of Homeland Security? You know, that's a new department that was opened up around 2002, I think. And mm-hmm. So your stance is to close it. Yeah.
Yes. And again, there just has to be a better way to do that. Lord knows we've got enough federal and state legal authorities, law enforcement departments that could do it. Private security had done it before 9/11, and in the aftermath of the attacks in New York and Pennsylvania and D.C., as people often do when they're shocked and afraid, we overreacted. And I remember those days that right after there were troops in airports all over the United States. And that's clearly a violation of the Posse Comitatus, but nobody was talking about that. Everybody wanted to feel secure, and so we did that. And then we carried that overreaction into setting up the Department of Homeland Security. And it has turned into what government agencies most frequently do. It's a farce. It doesn't provide what it's supposed to, security, from the types of threats that it was established for. And instead, you have federal employees acting like teenage boys and using highly expensive and intrusive equipment to stare at naked women and men. The pat-downs that they do of children and old people is just insane. And there are ways to protect the flying public. I think Israel does so without as much fanfare or as expense as we do. And lots of other countries do it better than we do without intruding on their citizens' rights. And Lord knows we did it before 9/11 in a much better fashion. I'd rather see us go back to what we were doing before and just be more alert and more aware.
Yeah, there were FBI agents on the trail of those terrorists that, you know, committed 9/11, and I guess the Department of Homeland Security was supposed to be a central place where different departments like the FBI and CIA can communicate, but instead it's like a huge department that costs, you know, probably more than all of those departments put together. So maybe there should be a way for like FBI, CIA to communicate better, or for whistleblowers, you know, some people lower on the chain of command to, you know, fast track some things that they think are red alert type material.
Exactly.
And I mean, because they were definitely on the trail of all of these people. I mean, so we just didn't listen to them, and maybe for political reasons. What do you think about whistleblowers like Edward Snowden or other people? I mean, it seems like if you were a whistleblower, you know, it'd probably be a dangerous thing. I mean, you might get fired, you might get shunned, you might go to jail in some cases. I mean, so it's not easy right now being a whistleblower for someone who wants to expose corruption in the system. I mean, but we probably should, have more, you know, an avenue for people to do something like that. If they, you know, because who would know what's corrupt besides better than some of the people that are honest that are working inside these systems?
Exactly. And we've set up, omnibus programs within departments and ombudsmans and all those things that are supposed to facilitate those kind of whistleblower actions. But instead, they have become exactly what they were before. Without the ombudsman and the extra expense, the department polices itself, you know. There's not an outside entity that is assigned to come in and look and see if the whistleblower is a disgruntled employee or former employee, or if he or she actually has information that could save money or lives or anything else. You're exactly right. Probably the bravest people in the United States right now are those who are willing to put their jobs and their future on the line to try to make something good happen, to correct some error or some wrong in the system. And just like Snowden, most often they are pushed aside, punished, and ultimately ignored. Snowden, I believe, is a hero. Now, obviously, I don't know everything about that situation, but what I do know is that the government habitually lies when caught doing something wrong. From Richard Nixon forward, and probably before that, the government and individuals in governance always react in the same way. Well, it's their fault. You know, somebody who's trying to do the right thing is made to be the culprit and accused in this case of treason. I don't believe it for a minute.
Yeah, and as far as security, sometimes just better hardware like cockpit doors that would help, having just a security officer on the plane who is authorized to have a weapon or something. I mean, just simple, that doesn't violate people's civil liberties, but it for sure would stop any terrorism. So let's look at some of the other issues here. You had here, let's see. Well, let me ask you, while I'm looking at some of these issues here, what about debates? Have you been in any of the debates? Are there debates coming up that you're going to be a part of, Frank?
Yes, we've been fortunate. The Republican incumbent is doing what, you know, incumbents in a state like Arkansas, where a Republican is expected to be reelected, he's avoiding all the debates. He's agreed to go to one, the ATN, the local, the statewide affiliate of the public education section, is holding one debate that they do every year, and it is such a part of the political background here in Arkansas that he can't avoid it. So we'll have that in October, and ATN has always been good since Greens and Libertarians started getting on the ballot here. They invite everybody to their debates. So I'll be in a three-way debate with the Republican and the Democrat in October. the Democrat and I had a debate in Fayetteville last 2 weeks ago now, and had an empty podium there for the senator if he bothered to show up, but of course he didn't. And we'll have another one the 30th of September in central Arkansas, somewhere around the Little Rock area, and perhaps one more after the AETM debate on, I believe, the 13th of October.
So that sounds really, really good, and I appreciate hearing that. And you also have here closed the Department of Education, and that might sound a little controversial, but maybe it's not. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. It's not as controversial as it sounds because it doesn't really change that much as far as education goes. I did over 20 years in private business, and in the second act of my life, I've had the pleasure of working at the Bauxite Public Schools in Bauxite, Arkansas, and it is a day and night change to the first act of my life. And one of the things that strikes anybody when you get into government education is the fact that the government at each level adds funding to the educational process. The local school district applies about 25-30% of the money in Arkansas, and the state government does about 55-60% of it. 10-15% of the funds come from the federal government. And with that money comes control. And the degree of control that the federal government has over the local schools here in Arkansas is becoming greater and greater, even though the financial contribution they're making is not. Some of that is complicity between the State Department of Education and the federal Education Department. Bureaucrats like bureaucrats, and they get along well together as they make their forward plans and their programs for education, supposedly. But lost in all of that is the local teacher, the local administrator, the local taxpayer, the local school board. Getting the federal government out of education would not have the impact that most people believe it would have on local education. Even if they took their money back, there would be ways to work around that, because in some cases, the money that you get from the federal government actually costs you more as you begin to have to comply with their regulations and their reporting requirements and all of the strings that are attached to it. But if they wanted to do block grants, you know, if you took the money that the Education Department gets every year now and quit paying the D.C. bureaucrats and instead sent most of that, probably more of that money, back to the states in block grants, I believe education would actually get more money and would begin to reflect those things in localities that are important to the people in the community.
Right, and it kind of reminds me, I saw a stat that I did not know the other day, but since America, I think through Nixon or Lyndon Johnson, declared a war on poverty, the poverty level has remained exactly the same, and we've spent trillions of dollars. We could have just given the money directly to the people who are in poverty, and sometimes I think about education, we spend about $12,000 per student on average, some places more, some mm-hmm. less. But if you gave every student $12,000 a year, they could, you know, you could get 10 of them that could hire a teacher for $100,000 a year, some top-notch, you know, brainiac person. I mean, so, yeah, there's a lot of ways to think about it. I mean, and on here you have here respect the Second Amendment and also respect the 10th Amendment. Those are two separate amendments, but maybe you could, talk about both of those issues one at a time or together.
Sure, and probably just the Constitution in general. I think we have lost sight of the fact that the Constitution is a compact between 50 states and an entity, the federal government, that they established a couple of hundred years ago. We are not like France. You know, the national government of France does not set up districts. I mean, and that's what they do in France. The national government sets up districts and operates through those districts, but it's like a business. You know, you have your CEO, you have your local and regional offices and administrators who run those. The United States was not set up that way and shouldn't be operating that way now. We are to look at the Constitution for what it is, the underlying law of the land, the way we govern our relationships between the states and the federal government and the individuals in the state, then it becomes a lot easier to protect individual liberty and freedom. The Second Amendment is under attack more than any other, I believe. And the reason is varied. Some people honestly believe that we need to be disarmed, that only the army and police should have guns. And from that extreme to the center of the current debate, there are people who would change the Second Amendment if they could. But the process for changing the Second Amendment is clear. The Constitution has been amended before, and it's always done the same way, the way we all agreed to in the beginning. The states or the federal government can propose a constitution, and then that proposed amendment is sent back to the states, and three-quarters of the states have to approve it. There is nothing that anybody could propose to change the Second Amendment that would pass in three-quarters of the states. So instead, they undermine the Second Amendment. They pass legislation that is clearly unconstitutional. The courts and well-meaning or ill-meaning judges, doesn't really matter, uphold those laws. It reminds me of what we read about before the Civil War and the Fugitive Slave Act. The Fugitive Slave Act was clearly unconstitutional, but the federal government and state governments enforced it and forced individuals in Minnesota to take slaves that escaped from Arkansas and return them to their slave owners, and if they didn't, it was a violation of federal law. So people in Minnesota were punished for not actively seeking out, getting, and returning slaves to the southern states. Incomprehensible that that could be enforced under our Constitution, even at that time. And yet it was for years. In the same way, they're enforcing unconstitutional laws governing the ownership, the keeping and bearing of arms now. And the real danger of that is that if we let that happen to the Second Amendment, then there's no reason for them not to do the same thing to the Fourth or the First or any other.
Yeah, they're all under attack, and so you're right. The whole Bill of Rights, the whole Constitution needs to be protected. You'll be swearing an oath to do that. I know everyone is, but like you said, there's judges, there's congresspeople passing different laws that try to chip away at it, and some of them, take a sledgehammer to it. So if you care about civil liberties, I mean, you might be a candidate that people would want to look at. But let me ask you this, besides, trying to pass gun laws and stuff like that, which, what are things just generally that you think, besides laws necessarily or laws against the Second Amendment or gun control laws, what are ways that, you think would actually practically reduce violence in the U.S.?
I think one of the things that disturbs me most is the idea that that the city of New York can pass laws concerning prohibition and gun rights and then enforce it in such a way that it is obviously racially biased. You look at the population, the makeup of New York City, and when they had the stop and frisk program, it applied to blacks and Hispanics at a much higher rate than it did the whites. And Mayor Bloomberg, you know, just reacted violently when it was struck down on the courts. Said awful things about the judge that struck it down. If someone had done that in South Carolina or Texas or Arkansas, it would have been, you know, it would have been obvious to everybody what it was. If we allow that sort of thing to happen in Texas, in Arkansas, or in New York, it undermines our respect for and appreciation of law and of law enforcement officers, or more correctly, peace officers. I think our whole way of doing business with law enforcement has generated a culture now in most of these United States where police officers are feared in the way the Bible tells us to. You know, the Bible said not to hassle the Roman centurions because he bare not the sword in vain. Well, we all know that police officer has a gun, and rather than respecting him for the difficult job he's doing, I'm afraid these days we fear him because he bears that gun not in vain. We know he may shoot us. We know that if he doesn't shoot us, he may file charges against us that are flimsy or even untruthful, and we may have to hire a lawyer. We may have to go to jail. And that's what's motivating too much of the relationship between peace officers, law enforcement officers, and the general public.
Yeah, and it sounds like what you're talking about is being consistent, and of course that's the definition of integrity. What about the war on drugs? Do you have a position on that? Or
yeah, it's just as insane as prohibition was in the 1920s. You know, there were no gunfights in the streets of Chicago, and eastern Oklahoma didn't have Pretty Boy Floyd before prohibition took place. When you take something and make it illegal simply, you know, based on something like that, all you do is drive up the price. And when the price gets high enough, then the really bad people get involved, and that's how Pretty Boy Floyd and the gentleman in Chicago got rich and famous. And we're doing exactly the same thing now. It's more global. You know, a lot of our drugs come from Colombia and Golden Triangle in Asia and other neighboring countries. And until we decide that the government at any level is not our daddy, it's not our mama, it's not there to look out for us and make us do the right thing, we'll continue to pay the price in unrest and loss of freedom that we did in the 20s and that we are now.
And the last people who want to end the war on drugs, ironically, is probably, you know, the drug cartels and groups like that.
My dad told me... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the stop and frisk also is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But, yes, you're going to tell us what your dad said. Yeah.
When Lubbock, Texas, Lubbock County was voting whether or not to go dry, stay dry or go wet in my youth, he told me that the Baptists and the bootleggers would keep it dry. And he was absolutely right. Being raised Baptist, you know, I understood why the Baptists were doing it, but he had to explain to me why the bootleggers didn't want it to go wet.
Yeah, exactly. That might go over a lot of people's heads, but it's very true. That's the last thing they want. They'll have to get a real job, and sell something else. And you also put fiscal responsibility. You don't think 20 or 19 to $20 trillion in debt isn't the perfect amount right now? Should we try to reduce that?
We have got to, because I spoke to the NAACP, my first public address after the nomination, was at NAACP in North Little Rock. And I knew that the people there probably didn't agree with me about a lot of things. And so what I talked about was that I was not just a politician, just a former mayor, just a former constable, just a former coroner. I was more importantly a father and a grandfather. And that what we were doing with our national debt was the most terrible thing we could do to our children, our grandchildren, and their children for generations to come, because everybody knows we can't pay that debt. We continue to run it up, and somebody will pay it someday in some way, and I will be deceased long before that happens, but my grandchildren will have the honor of paying for all the profligate spending that I allowed a Congress and a president to indulge in during my lifetime. And that is cross-generational slavery. No other way to look at it.
Yeah, look at Greece and some of these other countries. I mean, the only reason we can handle it now is because interest rates are below 1%. And
right.
I mean, if the interest rate was even at like 2%, I mean, you know, most of the pie of the chart of the budget would be going to paying interest. And yes, then we would be, in debt slaves, basically. And let me see if I have some other issues here. What about small and mid-sized businesses? I mean, I think that's an important fabric of our society, but the number of small and mid-sized businesses or new startups that have been formed every year for like the last couple of decades, if you look at a chart, has been going down. And you think that's unfortunate, or what would you say you would do to help small and mid-sized business?
It's not only unfortunate, it's deadly. The best thing we can do for those businesses, for the economy in general, for the consumers and taxpayers in our country, is to get the government out of all those situations. Because as you would expect to happen when government became receptive to money from large corporations, you know, when Citizens United, as a part of its impact, allowed corporations to be viewed as persons when it comes to donating money to campaigns, then the amount of money that flooded in to political campaigns from those corporations was huge. It was already large. It had to come through the corporations' individual owners and officers and managers, and this just made it all the easier. And so now, naturally, politicians respond to where the money comes from. And your local mom and pop or the four-state moderate-sized business operating, doing its work, don't have the kind of funds, the ability to impact legislation, to support political causes and individuals that the large mega corporations do. And I see corporations not as people, as the court did, but as fictions of government. You know, they are corporations only because the government passed legislation that enables us to have a corporation. And, of course, one of the big reasons that people wanted to have corporations was to avoid personal liability in their business dealings. So you start out by trying to protect a certain class of people from responsibility for their actions, and from that it's a natural progression to the point that now, I don't remember which universities, but professors from two prominent universities, Northwestern was one, and one of the Ivy League universities, I believe, did a study that showed that the Congress of the United States didn't give a darn what the people said or thought or wanted in legislation. They responded to the amount of money that came to them from interested parties in legislation, so that pharmaceutical contributions, defense contributions, farm contributions, the the largest five or six special interest groups had much, much, much more impact on what legislation was passed, and it had absolutely nothing to do with what polls showed the American people wanted.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. Think about it. Like, I never really thought about, like, you know, why do corporations exist anyways? I mean, people can still have groups and businesses and be liable
sure.
for them. I mean, if you didn't have corporations, it's not stopping someone from creating an organization. But, you know, it's kind of like someone saying, you know, I just want to create this fictitious character where I can do whatever I want, and then if that fictitious character, you know, does something bad or gets in trouble, then I'll just dissolve it and then create another fictitious character, you know, instead.
Yeah.
And so by proxy, I have this, like, impenetrable, you know, alter ego that's out there, you know, that's has a get out of jail free card or something like that. So
that's it. It would be like the officers in the Gestapo saying, well, you know, that wasn't me that did that. That was the Gestapo, or that was the SS that did that, and it's gone now, so you don't have to worry about that anymore. And, of course, at Nuremberg, we didn't buy that, and we shouldn't buy it now in America.
About foreign, like, let me ask you this, phrase it this way as far as foreign policy goes. If you were in the Senate, and if you were able to persuade people through arguments and facts, to see how we should do our foreign policy, how and you were able to implement the way you see it, instead of telling us what you would do, how would you envision America in 10 years from now and America with its relations with other countries in the world? What would the effects of what you would promote look like at the end of it?
I think what I would like to see us do through legislation and more frequently just by following the law would be what George Washington talked about. He called for honest, open friendship with all, talking about other countries in the world, entangling alliances with none. And, you know, for the first 150 years of our national existence, we were the largest neutral country in the world. You know, we were what Switzerland is now, what Sweden is now. We were habitually a neutral country. When other people fought, none of our business, nothing we can do about it anyway. I told a group, in fact, it was at the debate in Fayetteville, when we got to foreign policy, you know, there are awful things that happen in countries all over the globe every day, and there is literally nothing that the United States can do about it. We're not set up to be, I don't think we ought to want to be, the policeman of the world or the judge of the world or the military compliance arm of the United Nations. I believe we ought to do business with anybody who will do business with us on a fair trade basis, but that we should not become involved in the local affairs of any nation, anywhere, anytime. And there were reasons to become involved in other countries before World War I, when the United States became an international player. But it was when our personnel, you know, our foreign Americans overseas were seized by a government or something like that. Thomas Jefferson took some military action in North Africa for that reason. And, of course, any nation, like any individual, has the right to defend itself from fraud or force from other nations or individuals. But as far as becoming involved in the defense of Europe or Japan or Korea, we have dug a mighty hole for ourselves there. And the expense of doing so isn't just the billions of dollars that we spend keeping hundreds of bases open in dozens of countries around the world. It is in appearing to the rest of the world to not be a fair and honest broker when dealing with other countries.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of, for anyone who's ever watched Star Trek, maybe have or haven't, but the Prime Directive, you know, we don't want to interfere with these other planets. Well, Frank, good. Let me ask you in closing here, and it's something I ask everyone just to get a little glimpse of something overall, a glimpse here. Who's some of your past or present, favorite past or present people, elected or not?
You know, I think Thomas Jefferson is, I like him because he had such a soaring intellect and he was such a great spokesman for individual liberty and the rights of man. He was approachable in the sense that he knew what we did with slavery and the Constitution was not right. He had slaves himself, and he struggled with that. He didn't solve it, but he saw it, and that we can look at him and he's human. He made mistakes. He wasn't a paragon of virtue that we can never approach, but even though he's not that paragon of virtue, he understood individual liberty. Closer to home, at least in this, you know, someone who's alive now, Dr. Ron Paul is just a hero of mine. He is one of those people who has understood and done things to advance individual liberty. Not a perfect man. Nobody ever has been, or I suppose ever will be, but a heck of a guide for the rest of us who are trying to find our way toward that hopefully attainable goal of individual liberty.
It sounds great. And, well, good luck in your campaign. And on this November 8th, you know, there's, you know, just a little over 40 days left, a lot of people to reach out there. And, again, we're talking with Frank Gilbert, a Libertarian candidate for Senate, the U.S. Senate, running in Arkansas for the year 2016. Frank Gilbert, for Senate. .com. Any final words here, Frank? We appreciate your time.
Friend, I appreciate what y'all are doing. It is incredibly important. And as our candidate for president is saying this year, we're never going to agree on all the small things, but I think there is a growing majority of Americans who understand we have to agree on the big thing, which is that the Democrats and the Republicans have put us in an awful position. And it's time to either force them to begin doing the right thing or to send them home.
Yeah, maybe you'll be able to just, you know, ride the wave of reform. So hopefully there is a big wave of reform here in 2016. Well, thanks for your time. We appreciate it. Good luck again in your campaign and the debates, et cetera. Frank Gilbert, everyone. Well, take care, Frank. Thanks again.
Thanks, friend, and good night.